This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Gardens of the Moon by Stephen Erickson, performed by Ralph Lister. This novel is dedicated to I.C. Esselmont. Worlds to conquer, worlds to share. Now these ashes have grown cold, we open the old book. These oil-stained pages recount the tales of the fallen, a frayed empire, words without warmth. The hearth has ebbed. Its gleam and life sparks are but memories against dimming eyes. What cast my mind, what hue my thoughts, as I open the book of the fallen and breathe deep the scent of history? Listen, then, to these words carried on that breath. These tales are the tales of us all, again, yet again. We are history relived, and that is all. Without end, that is all. The Emperor is dead, so too his right hand, now cold, now severed. But mark these dying shadows, twinned and flowing, bloody and beaten, down and away from mortal sight. From scepter's rule dismissed, from guild candelabra the light now fled, from a hearth ringed in hard jewels, 7 years this warmth has bled. The Emperor is dead. So too his mastered companion the rope cut clean. But mark this burgeoning return, faltering dark, the tattered shroud, embracing children in empire's dying light. Hear now the dirge faint reprised before the sun's fall. This day spills red on buckled earth, and in obsidian eyes, vengeance chimes 7 times. Call to Shadow, Book 1, Chapter 1, Verses 1 through 18. Felicin, born 1146. Prologue. 1154th year of Burn's sleep, 96th year of the Malazan Empire, the last year of Emperor Kelenved's reign. The stains of rust seem to map blood seas on the black, pocked surface of Mok's vein. A century old, it squatted on the point of an old pike that had been bolted to the outer top of the hold's wall. Monstrous and misshapen, it had been cold-hammered into the form of a winged demon, teeth bared in a leering grin, and was tugged and buffeted in squealing protest with every gust of wind. The winds were contrary the day columns of smoke rose over the mouse quarter of Malar's city. The vein's silence announced the sudden falling off of the sea breeze that came clambering over the ragged walls of Mok's hold. Then it creaked back into life as the hot, spark-scattered and smoke-filled breath of the mouse quarter reached across the city to sweep the promontory's heights. Ganoer Stabro Paran of the House of Paran stood on tiptoe to see over the Merlin. Behind him rose Mok's hold, once capital of the Empire, but now, since the mainland had been conquered, relegated once more to a fist's holding. To his left rose the pike and its wayward trophy. For Ganoers, the ancient fortification overlooking the city was too familiar to be of interest. This visit was his third in as many years. He had long ago explored the courtyard with its heaved cobblestones, the old keep, now a stable, its upper floor home to pigeons and swallows and bats, and the citadel, where even now his father negotiated the island export tithe with the harbour officials. In the last instance, of course, a goodly portion was out of bounds, even for a son of a noble house. For it was in the citadel that the fist had his residence, and in the inner chambers that such affairs of the empire as concerned this island were conducted. Moxhold forgotten behind him, Ganawes's attention was on the tattered city below and the riots that ran through the Mouse, its poorest quarter. Moxhold stood atop a cliff. The higher land of the pinnacle was reached by a switchback staircase carved into the limestone of the cliff wall. The drop to the city below was 80 armspans or more, with the hold's battered wall adding still another 6. The Mouse was at the city's inland edge, an uneven spreading of hovels and overgrown tiers cut in half by the silt-heavy river that crawled toward the harbour. With most of Malar's city between Ganawes's position and the riots, it was hard to make out any detail beyond the growing pillars of black smoke. It was midday, but the flash and thundering concussion of Majory made the air seem dark and heavy. Armour clanking, a soldier appeared along the wall near him. The man leaned van-braced forearms on the battlement, the scabbard of his longsword scraping against the stones.
"Glad for your pure blood, eh?" he asked,
grey eyes on the smouldering city below. The boy studied the soldier. He already knew the complete regimental accoutrements of the Imperial Army, and the man at his side was a commander in the 3rd, one of the Emperor's own, an elite. On his dark grey shoulder cloak was a silver brooch, a bridge of stone lit by ruby flames. A bridge burner. High-ranking soldiers and officials of the Empire commonly passed through Moxhold. The island of Malaz remained a vital port of call, especially now that the Coral Wars to the south had begun. Ganawes had brushed shoulders with more than his share, here and in the capital, Unta.
"Is it true, then?" Ganawes asked boldly.
"Is what true?"
"The First Sword of Empire, Dasa Multor. We heard in the capital before we left. He's dead. Is it true? Is Dasim dead?"
The man seemed to flinch, his gaze unwavering on the Mouse.
"Such is war,"
he muttered under his breath, as if the words were not meant for anyone else's ears.
"You're with the 3rd. I thought the 3rd was with him, in 7 cities, at Igatan."
"It's breath. They're still looking for his body in the still hot rubble of that damn city. And here you are, a merchant's son 3,000 leagues from 7 cities with information only a few are supposed to possess."
He still did not turn.
"I know not your sources, but take my advice and keep what you know to yourself."
Ganawes shrugged.
"It said he betrayed a god."
Finally the man faced him. His face was scarred, and something that might have been a burn marred his jaw and left cheek. For all that, he looked young for a commander.
"Heed the lesson there, son."
"What lesson?"
"Every decision you make can change the world. The best life is the one the gods don't notice. You want to live free, boy? Live quietly."
"I want to be a soldier. A hero."
"You'll grow out of it."
Mox Vane squealed as a wayward gust from the harbour cleared the grainy smoke. Ganawes could now smell rotting fish and the waterfront's stink of humanity. Another bridge burner, this one with a broken, scorched fiddle strapped to his back, came up to the commander. He was wiry, and if anything younger, only a few years older than Ganawes himself, who was 12. Strange pockmarks covered his face and the backs of his hands, and his armor was a mixture of foreign accoutrements over a threadbare, stained uniform. A short sword hung in a cracked wooden scabbard at his hip. He leaned against the merlin beside the other man with the ease of long familiarity.
"It's a bad smell when sorcerers panic," the newcomer said. "They're losing control down there.
Hardly the need for a whole cadre of mages, just to sniff out a few wax witches."
The commander sighed.
"Thought to wait to see if they'd rein themselves in.
The soldier grunted.
They're all new, untested. This could scar some of them forever. Besides, he added, more than a few down there are following someone else's orders.
A suspicion, no more.
The proof's right there, the other man said. In the mouse.
Perhaps.
You're too protective, the man said. Surly says it's your greatest weakness.
Surly's the Emperor's concern, not mine.
A second grunt answered that.
Maybe all of us before too long.
The commander was silent, slowly turning to study his companion. The man shrugged.
Just a feeling. She's taking a new name, you know. Lassine.
Lassine?
Napan word means...
I know what it means.
Hope the Emperor does too.
Ganoes said, it means Throne Master. The two looked down at him. The wind shifted again, making the iron demon groan on its perch, a smell of cool stone from the hold itself.
My tutor's Napan, Ganoes explained.
A new voice spoke behind him, a woman's, imperious and cold.
Commander?
Both soldiers turned, but without haste. The commander said to his companion,
the new company needs help down there. Send Dujek in a wing and get some sappers to contain the fires. Wouldn't do to have the whole city burn.
The soldier nodded, marched away, sparing the woman not a single glance. She stood with two bodyguards near the portal in the Citadel Square Tower. Her dusky blue skin marked her as Napan, but she was otherwise plain, wearing a salt-stained grey robe, her mousy hair cut short like a soldier's, her features thin and unmemorable. It was, however, her bodyguards that sent a shiver through Ganoes. They flanked her, tall, swathed in black, hands hidden in sleeves, hoods shadowing their faces. Ganoes had never seen a claw before, but he instinctively knew these creatures to be acolytes of the cult, which meant the woman was.
The commander said, it's your mess, Surly. Seems I'll have to clean it up.
Ganoes was shocked at the absence of fear, the near contempt in the soldier's voice. Surly had created the claw, making it a power rivaled only by the Emperor himself.
That is no longer my name, Commander.
The man grimaced.
So I've heard. You must be feeling confident in the Emperor's absence. He's not the only one who remembers you as nothing more than a serving wench down in the old quarter. I take it the gratitude's washed off long since.
The woman's face betrayed no change of expression to mark if the man's words had stung.
The command was a simple one, she said. It seems your new officers are unable to cope with the task.
It's got out of hand, the commander said. They're unseasoned.
Not my concern, she snapped. Nor am I particularly disappointed. Loss of control delivers its own lessons to those who oppose us.
Oppose? A handful of minor witches selling their meager talents? To what sinister end? Finding the Korival schools on the shoals in the bay? Which breath, woman? Hardly a threat to the Empire.
Unsanctioned. Defiant of the new laws.
Your laws, Surly. They won't work. And when the Emperor returns, he'll quash your prohibition of sorcery. You can be certain of that.
The woman smiled coldly.
You'll be pleased to know that the tower signaled the approach of the transports for your new recruits. We'll not miss you or your restless, seditious soldiers, Commander.
Without another word or a single glance spared for the boy standing beside the commander, she swung about and, flanked by her silent bodyguards, re-entered the citadel. Ganoes and the commander returned their attention to the riot in the mouse. Flames were visible, climbing through the smoke.
One day, I'll be a soldier,
Ganoes said. The man grunted.
Only if you fail at all else, son. Taking up the sword is the last act of desperate men. Mark my words, and find yourself a more worthy dream.
Ganner was scowled.
You're not like the other soldiers I've talked to. You sound more like my father.
But I'm not your father, the man growled.
The world, Ganoes said, doesn't need another wine merchant.
The commander's eyes narrowed, gauging. He opened his mouth to make the obvious reply, then shut it again. Ganoes Paran looked back down at the burning quarter, pleased with himself.
Even a boy, commander, can make a point, he thought.
Moxvane swung once more. Hot smoke rolled over the wall, engulfing them. A reek of burning cloth, scorched paint and stone, and now of something sweet.
An abattoir's caught fire, Ganoes said. Pigs.
The commander grimaced. After a long moment he sighed and leaned back down on the merlin.
As you say, boy, as you say.
Book One. Pale. In the 8th year, the free cities of Genobacchus established contracts with a number of mercenary armies to oppose the Imperium's advance. Prominent among these were the Crimson Guard, under the command of Prince Kaz Devor, see Volumes 3 and 5, and the Tista and Yi regiments of Moonspawn, under the command of Caladan Brood and others. The forces of the Malazan Empire, commanded by High Fist Dujek Onearm, consisted in that year of the 2nd, 5th, and 6th armies, as well as legions of Maranth. In retrospect, two observations can be made. The first is that the Maranth Alliance of 1156 marked a fundamental change in the science of warfare for the Malazan Imperium, which would prove efficacious in the short term. The second observation worth noting is that the involvement of the sorceress Tista Andi of Moonspawn represented the beginning of the continent's sorcery enfilade, with devastating consequences. In the year of Burned Sleep, 1163, the Siege of Pale ended with a now legendary sorceress conflagration. Imperial Campaigns 1158-1194, Volume 4, Genobacchus, Imrigin Talabant, born 1151. Chapter 1. The old stones of this road have rung with iron black-shod hoofs and drums, where I saw him walking up from the sea between the hills, soaked red in sunset he came. A boy among the echoes. Sons and brothers all in ranks of warrior ghosts, he came to pass where I sat on the worn final league stone at day's end. His stride spoke loud, all I needed know of him on this road of stone. The boy walks, another soldier, another one, bright heart, not yet cooled to hard iron. Mother's Lament, Anonymous. 1161st year of Burned Sleep, 103rd year of the Malazan Empire, 7th year of Empress Lassine's rule.
Prod and pull, the old woman was saying. 'Tis the way of the Empress, as like the gods themselves.
She leaned to one side and spat, then brought a soiled cloth to her wrinkled lips.
3 husbands and 2 sons I saw after war.
The fisher girl's eyes shone as she watched the column of mounted soldiers thunder past, and she only half listened to the hag standing beside her. The girl's breath had risen to the pace of the magnificent horses. She felt her face burning, a flush that had nothing to do with the heat. The day was dying, the sun's red smear over the trees on her right, and the sea's sighing against her face had grown cool.
That was in the days of the Emperor, the hag continued. Could roast the bastard soul on a spit, but look on, lass. Lassine scatters bones with the best of them. She started with his, didn't she now?
The fisher girl nodded faintly. As befitted the lowborn, they waited by the roadside, the old woman burdened beneath a rough sack filled with turnips, the girl with a heavy basket balanced on her head. Every minute or so, the old woman shifted the sack from one bony shoulder to the other. With the riders crowding them on the road, and the ditch behind them a steep drop to broken rocks, she had no place to put down the sack.
"Scatters bones," I said. "Bones of husbands, bones of sons, bones of wives and bones of daughters. All the same to her, all the same to the Empire."
The old woman spat a second time.
"Three husbands and two sons. 10 coin apiece a year. 5 of 10's 50. 50 coin a year's cold company, lass. Cold in winter. Cold in bed."
The fisher girl wiped dust from her forehead. Her bright eyes darted among the soldiers passing before her. The young men atop their high-back saddles held expressions stern and fixed straight ahead. The few women who rode among them sat tall and somehow fiercer than the men. The sunset cast red glints from their helms, flashing so that the girl's eyes stung and her vision blurred.
"You are the fisherman's daughter," the old woman said. "I seen you afore on the road and down on the strand. Seen you and your dad at market. Missing an arm, ain't he? More bones for her collection is likely, eh?"
She made a chopping motion with one hand, then nodded.
"Mine's the first house on the track. I use the coin to buy candles. 5 candles I burn every night. 5 candles to keep old Rigger company. It's a tired house, full of tired things and me, one of them, lass. What you got in the basket there?"
Slowly the fisher girl realized that a question had been asked of her. She pulled her attention from the soldiers and smiled down at the old woman.
"I'm sorry," she said. "The horses are so loud."
Rigger raised her voice.
"I asked what you got in your basket, lass."
"Twine. Enough for 3 nets. We need to get one ready for tomorrow. Dada lost his last one. Something in the deep waters took it, and a whole catch, too. Il Grand Lender wants the money he loaned us, and we need a catch tomorrow. A good one."
She smiled again and swept her gaze back to the soldiers.
"Isn't it wonderful?" she breathed.
Rigger's hand shot out and snagged the girl's thick black hair, yanked it hard. The girl cried out. The basket on her head lurched and slid down onto one shoulder. She grabbed frantically for it, but it was too heavy. The basket struck the ground and split apart.
"Ahee!"
the girl gasped, attempting to kneel. But Rigger pulled and snapped her head around.
"You listen to me, lass."
The old woman's sour breath hissed against the girl's face.
"The Empire's been grinding this land down for 100 years. You was born in it. I wasn't. When I was your age, Idko Khan was a country. We flew a banner, and it was ours. We were free, lass."
The girl was sickened by Rigger's breath. She squeezed shut her eyes.
"Mark this truth, child, else the cloak of lies blinds you forever."
Rigger's voice took on a droning cadence, and all at once the girl stiffened.
"Rigger. Rigger lied the seer, the wax witch, who trapped souls in candles and burned them. Souls devoured in flame,"
thought the girl. Rigger's words carried the chilling tone of prophecy.
"Mark this truth. I am the last to speak to you. You are the last to hear me. Thus are we linked, you and I, beyond all else."
Rigger's fingers snagged tighter in the girl's hair.
"Across the sea, the Empress has driven her knife into virgin soil. The blood now comes in a tide, and it'll sweep you under, child, if you're not careful. They'll put a sword in your hand. They'll give you a fine horse, and they'll send you across that sea. But a shadow will embrace your soul. Now, listen. Bury this deep. Vigor will preserve you, because we are linked, you and I. But it is all I can do. Understand? Look to the Lord spawned in darkness. His is the hand that shall free you, though he'll know it not.
What's this?
A voice bellowed. Rigger swung to face the road. An outrider had slowed his mount. The seer released the girl's hair. The girl staggered back a step. A rock on the road's edge turned underfoot and she fell. When she looked up, the outrider had trotted past. Another thundered up in his wake.
"Leave the pretty one alone, hag,"
this one growled. And as he rode by, he leaned in his saddle and swung an open, gauntleted hand. The iron-scaled glove cracked against Rigger's head, spinning her around. She toppled. The fisher girl screamed as Rigger landed heavily across her thighs. A thread of crimson spit spattered her face. Whimpering, the girl pushed herself back across the gravel, then used her feet to shove away Rigger's body. She climbed to her knees. Something within Rigger's prophecy seemed lodged in the girl's head, heavy as a stone and hidden from light. She found she could not retrieve a single word the seer had said. She reached out and grasped Rigger's woolen shawl. Carefully, she rolled the old woman over. Blood covered one side of Rigger's head, running down behind the ear. More blood smeared her lined chin and stained her mouth. The eyes stared sightlessly. The fisher girl pulled back, unable to catch her breath. Desperate, she looked about. The column of soldiers had passed, leaving nothing but dust and the distant tremble of hooves. Rigger's bag of turnips had spilled onto the road. Among the trampled vegetables lay 5 tallow candles. The girl managed a ragged lungful of dusty air. Wiping her nose, she looked to her own basket.
"Never mind the candles,"
she mumbled in a thick, odd voice.
"They're gone, aren't they now? Just a scattering of bones, never mind."
She crawled toward the bundles of twine that had fallen from the breached basket, and when she spoke again, her voice was young, normal.
"We need the twine. We'll work all night and get one ready. Dada's waiting. He's right at the door. He's looking up the track. He's waiting to see me."
She stopped, a shiver running through her. The sun's light was almost gone. An unseasonal chill bled from the shadows, which now flowed like water across the road.
"Here it comes, then,"
the girl grated softly, in a voice that wasn't her own. A soft-gloved hand fell on her shoulder. She ducked down, cowering.
"Easy, girl," said a man's voice. "It's over. Nothing to be done for her now."
The fisher girl looked up. A man swathed in black leaned over her, his face obscured beneath a hood shadow.
"But he hit her,"
the girl said in a child's voice.
"And we have nets to tie, me and Dada."
"Let's get you on your feet,"
the man said, moving his long-fingered hands down under her arms. He straightened, lifting her effortlessly. Her sandaled feet dangled in the air before he set her down. Now she saw a second man, shorter, also clothed in black. This one stood on the road and was turned away, his gaze in the direction the soldiers had gone. He spoke, his voice reed thin.
"Wasn't much of a life,"
he said, not turning to face her.
"A minor talent, long since dried up of the gift. Oh, she might have managed one more, but we'll never know, will we?"
The fisher girl stumbled over to Rigger's bag and picked up a candle. She straightened, her eyes suddenly hard, then deliberately spat onto the road. The shorter man's head snapped toward her. Within the hood it seemed the shadows played alone. The girl shrank back a step.
good life, she whispered. She had these candles, you see. Five of them. Five for necromancy.
The short man cut in. The taller man, still at her side, said softly, I see them, child. I understand what they mean. The other man snorted.
The witch harbored five frail, weak souls. Nothing grand.
He cocked his head.
I can hear them now, calling for her.
Tears filled the girl's eyes. A wordless anguish seemed to well up from that black stone in her mind. She wiped her cheeks.
Where did you come from?
She asked abruptly.
We didn't see you on the road.
The man beside her half turned to the gravel track. On the other side, he said, a smile in his tone.
Waiting. Just like you.
The other giggled.
On the other side, indeed.
He faced down the road again and raised his arms. The girl drew in a sharp breath as darkness descended. A loud, tearing sound filled the air for a moment, then the darkness dissipated, and the girl's eyes widened. Seven massive hounds now sat around the man in the road. The eyes of these beasts glowed yellow, and all were turned in the same direction as the man himself. She heard him hiss.
Eager, are we? Then go.
Silently, the hounds bolted down the road. Their master turned and said to the man beside her,
Something to gnaw on Lassine's mind.
He giggled again.
Must you complicate things?
The other answered wearily. The short man stiffened.
They are within sight of the column.
He cocked his head. From up the road came the scream of horses. He sighed.
You've reached a decision, Cotillion?
The other grunted amusedly.
Using my name, Amanas, means you've just decided for me. We can hardly leave her here now, can we?
Of course we can, old friend. Just not breathing.
Cotillion looked down on the girl.
No, he said quietly. She'll do.
The fisher girl bit her lip. Still clutching Rigger's candle, she took another step back, her wide eyes darting from one man to the other.
Pity,
Amanas said. Cotillion seemed to nod, then he cleared his throat and said,
It'll take time.
An amused note entered Amanas's reply.
And have we time? True vengeance needs the slow, careful stalking of the victim. Have you forgotten the pain she once delivered us? Lassine's back is against the wall already. She might fall without our help. Where would be the satisfaction in that?
Cotillion's response was cool and dry.
You've always underestimated the Empress. Hence our present circumstances. No.
He gestured at the fisher girl.
We'll need this one. Lassine's raised the ire of Moonspawn, and that's a hornet's nest, if ever there was one. The timing is perfect.
Faintly, above the screaming horses, came the shrieks of men and women, a sound that pierced the girl's heart. Her eyes darted to Rigger's motionless form on the roadside, then back to Amanas, who now approached her. She thought to run, but her legs had weakened to a helpless trembling. He came close and seemed to study her, even though the shadows within his hood remained impenetrable.
A fisher girl?
He asked, in a kindly tone. She nodded.
Have you a name?
Enough, Cotillion growled. She's not some mouse under your paw, Amanas. Besides, I've chosen her. And I will choose her name as well.
Amanas stepped back.
Pity,
he said again. The girl raised imploring hands.
Please,
she begged Cotillion.
I've done nothing. My father's a poor man, but he'll pay you all he can. He needs me and the twine. He's waiting right now.
She She felt herself go wet between her legs and quickly sat down on the ground.
I've done nothing.
Shame rose through her, and she put her hands in her lap.
Please.
I've no choice anymore, child, Cotillion said. After all, you know our names.
I've never heard them before,
the girl cried. The man sighed. With what's happening up the road right now, well, you'd be questioned. Unpleasantly, there are those who know our names.
You see, lass,
Amanas added, suppressing a giggle.
We're not supposed to be here. There are names, and then there are names.
He swung to Cotillion and said in a chilling voice,
Her father must be dealt with.
My hounds?
No, Cotillion said. He lives.
Then how?
I suspect, Cotillion said, greed will suffice once the slate is wiped clean.
Sarcasm filled his next words.
I'm sure you can manage the sorcery in that, can't you?
Amanas giggled.
Beware of shadows bearing gifts.
Cotillion faced the girl again. He lifted his arms out to the sides. The shadows that held his features in darkness now flowed out around his body. Amanas spoke, and to the girl his words seemed to come from a great distance.
She's ideal. The Empress could never track her down, could never even so much as guess.
He raised his voice.
It's not so bad a thing, lass, to be the pawn of a god.
Prod and pull,
the fisher girl said quickly. Cotillion hesitated at her strange comment, then he shrugged. The shadows whirled out to engulf the girl. With their cold touch, her mind fell away, down into darkness. Her last fleeting sensation was of the soft wax of the candle in her right hand, and how it seemed to well up between the fingers of her clenched fist. The captain shifted in his saddle and glanced at the woman riding beside him.
We've closed the road on both sides, Agent. Moved the local traffic inland. So far, no words leaked.
He wiped sweat from his brow and winced. The hot woolen cap beneath his helm had rubbed his forehead raw.
Something wrong, Captain?
He shook his head, squinting up the road.
Helmet's loose. Had more hair the last time I wore it.
The adjunct to the Empress did not reply. The mid-morning sun made the road's white, dusty surface almost blinding. The captain felt sweat running down his body, and the mail of his helm's lobster tail kept nipping the hairs on his neck. Already his lower back ached. It had been years since he'd last ridden a horse, and the roll was slow in coming. With every saddle bounce, he felt vertebrae crunch. It had been a long time since somebody's title had been enough to straighten him up. But this was the adjunct to the Empress, Lassine's personal servant, an extension of her imperial will. The last thing the captain wanted was to show his misery to this young, dangerous woman. Up ahead, the road began its long, winding ascent. A salty wind blew from their left, whistling through the newly budding trees lining that side of the road. By mid-afternoon, that wind would breathe hot as a baker's oven, carrying with it the stench of the mudflats. And the sun's heat would bring something else as well. The captain hoped to be back in Cannes by then. He tried not to think about the place they rode toward. Leave that to the adjunct. In his years of service to the Empire, he'd seen enough to know when to shut everything down inside his skull. This was one of those times. The adjunct spoke.
You've been stationed here long, Captain?
Aye, the man growled. The woman waited, then asked,
How long?
He hesitated.
13 years, adjunct.
You fought for the Emperor, then? She said.
Aye.
And survived the purge?
The captain threw her a look. If she felt his gaze, she gave no indication. Her eyes remained on the road ahead. She rolled easily in the saddle, the scabbarded longsword hitched high under her left arm, ready for mounted battle. Her hair was either cut short or drawn up under her helm. Her figure was lithe enough, the captain mused.
"Finished?" she asked. "I was asking about the purges commanded by Empress Lassine, following her predecessor's untimely death."
The captain gritted his teeth, ducked his chin to draw up the helm strap. He hadn't had time to shave, and the buckle was chafing.
"Not everyone was killed, adjunct. The people of Itkokan aren't exactly excitable. None of those riots and mass executions that hit other parts of the Empire. We all just sat tight and waited."
"I take it," the adjunct said with a slight smile. "You're not noble-born, Captain."
He grunted. "If I'd been noble-born, I wouldn't have survived, even here in Itkokan. We both know that. Her orders were specific, and even the droll Khanis didn't dare disobey the Empress." He scowled. "No. Up through the ranks, adjunct."
"Your last engagement?"
"Wiccan Plains."
They rode on in silence for a time, passing the occasional soldier stationed on the road. Off to their left, the trees fell away to ragged heather, and the sea beyond showed its white-capped expanse. The adjunct spoke.
"This area you've contained, how many of your guard have you deployed to patrol it?"
1,100, the captain replied.
Her head turned at this, her cool gaze tightening beneath the rim of her helm. The captain studied her expression.
"The carnage stretches half a league from the sea, adjunct, and a quarter league inland."
The woman said nothing. They approached the summit. A score of soldiers had gathered there, and others waited along the slope's rise. All had turned to watch them.
"Prepare yourself, adjunct."
The woman studied the faces lining the roadside. She knew these to be hardened men and women, veterans of the siege of Li Heng and the Wiccan Wars out on the North Plains. But something had been clawed into their eyes that had left them raw and exposed. They looked upon her with a yearning that she found disturbing, as if they hungered for answers. She fought the urge to speak to them as she passed, to offer whatever comforting words she could. Such gifts were not hers to give, however, nor had they ever been. In this, she was much the same as the Empress. From beyond the summit, she heard the cries of gulls and crows, a sound that rose into a high-pitched roar as they reached the rise. Ignoring the soldiers on either side, the adjunct moved her horse forward. The captain followed. They came to the crest and looked down. The road dipped here for perhaps a fifth of a league, climbing again at the far end to a promontory. Thousands of gulls and crows covered the ground, spilling over into the ditches and among the low, rough heather and gorse. Beneath this churning sea of black and white, the ground was a uniform red. Here and there rose the ribbed humps of horses, and from among the squalling birds came the glint of iron. The captain reached up and unstrapped his helm. He lifted it slowly from his head, then set it down over his saddle horn.
"Adjunct?"
"I am named Lorne," the woman said softly.
175 men and women, 210 horses, the 19th Regiment of the Itkokani's 8th Cavalry."
The captain's throat tightened briefly. He looked at Lorne.
"Dead."
His horse shied under him as it caught an updraft. He closed savagely on the reins, and the animal stilled, nostrils wide and ears back, muscles trembling under him. The adjunct stallion made no move.
"All had their weapons bared. All fought whatever enemy attacked them. But the dead are all ours."
"You've checked the beach below?"
Lorne asked, still staring down on the road.
No signs of a landing, the captain replied.
No tracks anywhere.
Neither seaward nor inland. There are more dead than these, adjunct. Farmers, peasants, fisherfolk, travellers on the road. All of them torn apart, limbs scattered. Children, livestock, dogs.
He stopped abruptly and turned away.
Over 400 dead, he grated. We're not certain of the exact count.
Of course,
Lorne said, her tone devoid of feeling.
No witnesses?
None.
A man was riding toward them on the road below, leaning close to his horse's ear as he talked the frightened animal through the carnage. Birds rose in shrieking complaint in front of him, settling against once he had passed.
Who is that?
The adjunct asked. The captain grunted.
Lieutenant Gano is Paran. He's new to my command. From Unta.
Lorne's eyes narrowed on the young man. He'd reached the edge of the depression, stopping to relay orders to the work crews. He leaned back in his saddle then, and glanced in their direction.
Paran? From House Paran?
Aye. Gold in his veins and all that.
Call him up here.
The captain gestured and the lieutenant kicked his mount's flanks. Moments later he reined in beside the captain and saluted. The man and his horse were covered from head to toe in blood and bits of flesh. Flies and wasps buzzed hungrily around them. Lorne saw in Lieutenant Paran's face none of the youth that rightly belonged there. For all that, it was an easy face to rest eyes upon.
You check the other side, Lieutenant?
The captain asked. Paran nodded.
Yes, sir. There's a small fishing settlement down from the promontory, a dozen or so huts. Bodies in all but two. Most of the barks look to be in, though there's one empty mooring pole.
Lorne cut in.
Lieutenant, describe the empty huts.
He batted at a threatening wasp before answering.
One was at the top of the strand, just off the trail from the road. We think it belonged to an old woman we found dead on the road, about half a league south of here.
Why?
Adjunct, the hut's contents were that of an old woman. Also, she seemed in the habit of burning candles. Tallow candles, in fact. The old woman on the road had a sack full of turnips and a handful of tallow candles. Tallow's expensive here, adjunct.
Lorne asked,
How many times have you ridden through this battlefield, Lieutenant?
Enough to be getting used to it, adjunct.
He grimaced.
And the second empty hut?
A man and a girl, we think. The hut's close to the tide mark, opposite the empty mooring pole.
No sign of them?
None, adjunct. Of course, we're still finding bodies along the road, out in the fields.
But not on the beach?
No.
The adjunct frowned, aware that both men were watching her.
Captain, what kind of weapons killed your soldiers?
The captain hesitated, then turned a glare on the lieutenant.
You've been crawling around down there, Paran. Let's hear your opinion.
Paran's answering smile was tight.
Yes, sir. Natural weapons.
The captain felt a sinking feeling in his stomach. He had hoped he'd been wrong.
What do you mean?
Lorne asked.
Natural weapons.
Teeth, mostly. Very big. Very sharp ones.
The captain cleared his throat, then said,
There haven't been wolves in Itgokan for 100 years. In any case, no carcasses around.
If it was wolves, Paran said, turning to eye the basin, they were as big as mules.
No tracks, adjunct. Not even a tuft of hair.
Not wolves, then,
Lorne said.
Paran shrugged.
The adjunct drew a deep breath, held it, then let it out in a slow sigh.
I want to see this fishing village.
The captain made ready to don his helmet, but the adjunct shook her head.
Lieutenant Perrin will suffice, Captain. I suggest you take personal command of your guard in the meantime. The dead must be removed as quickly as possible. All evidence of the massacre is to be erased.
Understood, Adjunct, the captain said, hoping it kept the relief out of his voice.
Lorne turned to the young noble.
Well, Lieutenant?
He nodded and clucked his horse into motion.
It was when the birds scattered from their path that the adjunct found herself envying the captain. Before her, the roused carrion eaters exposed a carpet of armor, broken bones, and meat. The air was hot, turgid, and cloying. She saw soldiers still helmed, their heads crushed by what must have been huge, terribly powerful jaws. She saw torn mail, crumpled shields, and limbs that had been ripped from bodies. Lorne managed only a few moments of careful examination of the scene around them before she fixed her gaze on the promontory ahead, unable to encompass the magnitude of the slaughter. Her stallion, bred of the finest lines of Seven Cities stock, a warhorse trained in the blood for generations, had lost its proud, unyielding strut, and now picked its way carefully along the road. Lorne realized she needed a distraction and sought it in conversation.
Lieutenant, have you received your commission yet?
No, Adjunct. I expect to be stationed in the capital.
She raised an eyebrow.
Indeed. And how will you manage that?
Perrin squinted ahead, a tight smile on his lips.
It will be arranged.
I see.
Lorne fell silent.
The nobles have refrained from seeking military commissions, kept their heads low for a long time, haven't they?
Since the first days of the Empire. The Emperor held no love for us, whereas Empress Lassine's concerns seem to lie elsewhere.
Lorne eyed the young man.
I see you like taking risks, Lieutenant, she said. Unless your presumption extends to goading the adjunct to the Empress. Are you that confident of your blood's invincibility?
Since when is speaking the truth presumptuous?
You are young, aren't you?
This seemed to sting Perrin. A flush rose in his smooth-shaven cheeks.
Adjunct, for the past 7 hours I have been knee-deep in torn flesh and spilled blood. I've been fighting crows and gulls for bodies.
Do you know what these birds are doing here? Precisely.
They're tearing off strips of meat and fighting over them. They're getting fat on eyeballs and tongues, livers and hearts. In their frantic greed, they fling the meat around.
He paused, visibly regaining control over himself, as he straightened in his saddle.
I'm not young anymore, Adjunct. As for presumption, I honestly couldn't care less. Truth can't be danced around, not out here, not now, not ever again.
They reached the far slope. Off to the left, a narrow track led down toward the sea. Perrin gestured to it, then angled his horse forward. Lorne followed, her thoughtful expression holding the lieutenant's broad back, before she turned her attention to the route they took. The path was narrow, skirting the promontory's bluff. Off to the left, the trail's edge dropped away to rocks 60 feet below. The tide was out, the waves breaking on a reef a few hundred yards offshore. Pools filled the black bedrock's cracks and basins, dully reflecting an overcast sky. They came to a bend, and beyond and below stretched a crescent-shaped beach. Above it, at the promontory's foot, lay a broad, grassy shelf on which squatted a dozen huts. The adjunct swung her gaze seaward. The barks rested on their low flanks beside their mooring poles. The air above the beach and the tidal flat was empty, not a bird in sight. She halted her mount. A moment later, Perrin glanced back at her, then did the same. He watched her as she removed her helmet and shook out her long, auburn hair. It was wet and stringy with sweat. The lieutenant rode back to her side, a questioning look in his eyes.
Lieutenant Parron, your words were well spoken.
She breathed in the salty air, then met his gaze.
You won't be stationed in Unta, I'm afraid. You will be taking your orders from me as a commissioned officer on my staff.
His eyes slowly narrowed. What happened to those soldiers, Adjunct? She didn't answer immediately, leaning back on her saddle and scanning the distant sea.
Someone's been here, she said. A sorcerer of great power. Something's happened, and we're being diverted from discovering it.
Parron's mouth dropped open. Killing 400 people was a diversion.
If that man and his daughter had been out fishing, they'd have come in with the tide. But you won't find their bodies, Lieutenant.
Parron was puzzled. Now what? She glanced at him, then swung her horse around.
We go back.
That's it. He stared after her as she directed her mount back up the trail, then rode to catch up. Wait a minute, Adjunct, he said as he came alongside. She gave him a warning look. Parron shook his head. No, if I'm now on your staff, I have to know more about what's going on. She placed her helmet back on and cinched tight the strap under her chin. Her long hair dangled in tattered ropes down over her imperial cape.
Very well. As you know, Lieutenant, I'm no mage.
No, Parron cut in with a cold grin. You just hunt them down and kill them.
Don't interrupt me again. As I was saying, I am anathema to sorcery. That means, Lieutenant, that even though I'm not a practitioner, I have a relationship with magic, of sorts. We know each other, if you will. I know the patterns of sorcery, and I know the patterns of the minds that use it. We were meant to conclude that the slaughter was thorough and random. It was neither. There's a path here, and we have to find it.
Slowly Parron nodded.
Your first task, Lieutenant, is to ride to the market town. What's its name again?
Garum.
Yes, Garum. They'll know this fishing village, since that's where the catch is sold. Ask around. Find out which fisher family consisted of a father and daughter. Get me their names and their descriptions. Use the militia if the locals are recalcitrant.
They won't be, Parron said. The Cannies are cooperative folk. They reached the top of the trail and stopped at the road. Below, wagons rocked among the bodies, the oxen braying and stamping their blood-soaked hooves. Soldiers shouted in the press, while overhead wheeled thousands of birds. The scene stank of panic. At the far end stood the captain, his helmet hanging from its strap in one hand. The adjunct stared down on the scene with hard eyes.
For their sake, she said, I hope you're right, Lieutenant.
As he watched the two riders approach, something told the captain that his days of ease in Itko-Kan were numbered. His helmet felt heavy in his hand. He eyed Parron. The thin-blooded bastard had it made. 100 strings pulling him every step of the way to some cushy posting in some peaceful city, he thought. He saw Lorne studying him as they came to the crest.
Captain, I have a request for you.
The captain grunted. Request? Hell, the Empress has to check her slippers every morning to make sure this one isn't already in them, he thought.
Of course, Adjunct.
The woman dismounted, as did Parron. The lieutenant's expression was impassive. Was that arrogance? Or had the adjunct given him something to think about?
Captain, Lorne began, I understand there's a recruiting drive underway in Cannes. Do you pull in people from outside the city?
To join? Sure,
More of them than anyone else.